man sagged into it.
"Oh, dear,"
Persephone said, observing this bonelessness of the gray man.
"So you found out, did you?"
By way of response, he drained his glass. The readings had taken him to a clearing with 100 white Mitsubishi Evolutions and 2 drunk boys manifesting their dreams. He had watched them for hours, each minute, each impossible dream, each overheard snatch of conversation had hammered in the truth.
"What happens now?"
Mora asked. The gray man said, "I'm a hitman, not a kidnapper." Mora frowned.
"But you think your employer might be?"
The gray man was not sure what he thought Green Mantle might be. He knew that Green Mantle didn't like to lose, and he knew that he had been obsessed with the Grey Warren for at least 5 years. He also knew he himself had probably bludgeoned the last Grey Warren to death with a tire iron. Although the gray man had killed quite a few people, he had never destroyed any of the artifacts he'd been sent to collect. This was all more complicated than he'd expected. "It's definitely those 2 boys, isn't it?" It wasn't a question, though. The gray man tried to imagine bringing one of them back to Green Mantle. He was unaccustomed to transporting live victims for any distance. It struck him as oddly distasteful, a different animal from outright killing.
"2, Calla echoed. She and Persephone looked at each other.
"Well,"
Persephone said in her small voice. She used a cocktail umbrella to rescue a gnat in her drink.
"That makes more sense."
"It's not a thing," Mora said. "That's what's important. It's not a thing any more than conjunctivitis is a thing." Rubbing her eye, Persephone murmured,
"That's a strangely unpleasant metaphor, Mora."
"It's nothing you can take back," Mora clarified. She added pointedly, "And we know at least one of the boys. We'd be very angry if you took him. I'd be very angry with you." "He's not a very kind man," the gray man said. It hadn't gotten in the way of their relationship before. Kindness had, until then, been largely lost on the gray man.
"So you couldn't explain what nice boys they are?"
Persephone asked. Calla growled.
"They are not nice boys. Well, at least one of them isn't,"
the gray man said. "I don't expect it would make a difference to him anyway." With a deep sigh, he leaned his head far back and closed his eyes, as defenseless as he'd ever been. The afternoon sun lit his face and neck and muscled biceps and also lit Mora looking at them. They all took a drink, except for the gray man, who had already finished his. He didn't want to kidnap a boy. He didn't want to anger Mora. He just wanted. Cicadas sang madly from the trees. It was so impossibly summer. He wanted to stay.
"Well," Calla said, checking her watch and standing, "I don't envy you. I've got my boxing. Must run. Ta-ta. Mora, don't get murdered."
Mora waved the switchblade. Persephone, standing as well, said,
"I'd give that to Blue if I were you. I'm going to go work on my thing. My stuff. My PhD, you know."
The gray man opened his eyes, and now Persephone stopped in front of him, her hands folded around her empty glass. She looked very small and delicate, and not really there in comparison to his knotted presence. She removed one hand from her glass to gently pat his knee.
"I know you'll do the right thing, Mr. Gray."
She and Calla slid the door shut behind themselves. Mora scooted her butt a few inches closer and leaned against his leg. It struck the gray man as a very trusting gesture, putting her back to a hitman. His previously lifeless heart flopped hopefully. He carefully rearranged the daisy chain in her hair, and then he took out his phone. Green Mantle answered at once.
"Give me good news,"
the gray man said. "It's not here." There was a long pause.
"Sorry, the connection is bad. Say it again."
The gray man didn't like repeating himself unnecessarily. He said, "All of the readings are because of an old fault line that runs along these mountains. They're pointing you to a place, not a thing." Another pause, uglier in quality than the first. Green Mantle said,
So, who got to you?
Was it one of Lamonnier's? What did he say he'd pay you? You know what? God damn, this is not the day you want to mess with me. Today of all days.
The gray man said, I'm not angling for more money.
So you're keeping it for yourself?
I feel like that should make me feel better, but it doesn't. Usually it took Greenmantle a few minutes to work himself up to a frenzy, but it was clear the gray man had interrupted one already in progress.
All these years I've trusted you, you creepy, sick bastard, and now...
I don't have it, the gray man interrupted. I'm not cheating you. Beside him, Mora ducked her head and shook it a little. Even without knowing Greenmantle, she'd already guessed what the gray man knew. This wasn't going to work.
Have I ever lied to you? Greenmantle demanded. No, I haven't lied to anybody, and yet today everybody is just insistent on. You know, why didn't you just wait 4 months and tell me you couldn't find it? Why didn't you make a better lie?
The gray man said, I prefer the truth. The energy anomalies follow the course of the fault and escape through the established bedrock in certain areas. I've photographed some of the abnormalities in plant growth these energy leakages have caused. The power company has been battling surges connected to the leakages for quite some time. And activity is only intensified because of an earthquake that happened earlier this year. There's full documentation of that available on online newspapers. I can walk you through it when I return the electronics. He stopped. He waited. There was a brief moment where he thought, he will believe me. Greenmantle hung up on him. The gray man and Mora sat quietly and looked at the large, spreading beech tree that took up most of the backyard. A mourning dove called from it, persistent and dolorous. The gray man's hand hung down, and Mora stroked it. This is the Ten of Swords, he guessed. Mora kissed the back of his hand. You're going to have to be brave. The gray man said, I'm always brave. She said, braver than that. 47. Ganzi had only a few seconds of warning before the Camaro hit him. He was sitting at a stoplight near Monmouth Manufacturing when he heard the familiar, anemic sound of the pig's horn honking. Possibly he had imagined it. As he blinked out the windows and the rearview mirror, the Suburban shook slightly. Something had pushed it from behind. The pig's horn quacked again. Rolling down the window, Ganzi craned his head out to see behind the Suburban. He heard Ronan's hysterical laugh before he managed to glimpse the pig, and then the engine revved up and Ronan nudged the Camaro into the Suburban's rear bumper again. It was about the sort of homecoming he should have expected after the disastrous weekend. Hey, old man! Ronan! Shouted Ganzi. He had no other words. Wrecked. The quarter panel he could see looked fine. He didn't want to see the rest. He wanted to preserve the idea of the Camaro, whole and entire, for a few moments longer. Pull over! Ronan howled back. There was still rather a lot of a laugh to his voice. Mennonites! Now! I don't want to see it! Ganzi shouted back. The light turned green above him. He didn't move. Oh, you really do! He really didn't, but he still did as Ronan asked, pulling through the light and making the next right into Henrietta Farm and Garden and Home, a complex of shops largely staffed by Mennonites. It was a fine one-stop destination for vegetables, antiques, doghouses, western wear, military surplus, Civil War bullets, chili dogs, and custom chandeliers. He was aware of eyes from the outdoor vegetable stands as he parked the Suburban as far away from the buildings as possible. As he climbed out, the pig thundered into the spot next to him, and there wasn't a thing wrong with it. Ganzi pressed a finger to his temple, struggling to reconcile the texts from earlier with what he was seeing. It was possible Kavinsky had just been jerking his chain, but still, here was Ronan, climbing from the driver's seat, which was impossible. The keys remained in Ganzi's bag. Ronan leapt from the car, and this too was bewildering. Because he was grinning, euphoric.
It wasn't that Gansey hadn't seen Ronan happy since Neil Lynch died. It was just that there had always been something cruel and conditional about it. Not this Ronan. He seized Gansey's arm. Look at it, man! Look at it! Gansey was looking. He was staring, first at the Camaro, and then at Ronan, then back again. He kept rinsing and repeating, and nothing made any more sense. He stepped slowly around the car, looking for a hammered-out dent or a scratch. What's going on? I thought it was wrecked.
It was, Ronan said. It totally was.
He released Gansey's arm, but only to punch it.
I'm sorry, man. It was a shitty thing for me to do.
Gansey's eyes were wide. He hadn't thought he would live long enough to hear Ronan apologize for anything. He realized belatedly that Ronan was still talking.
What? What did you say? I said, Ronan said, and now he grabbed Gansey's shoulders, both of them, and shook them theatrically. I said, I dreamt this car. I did this. That's from my head. It's exactly the same, man. I did it. I know how my dad got everything he wanted, and I know how to control my dreams, and I know what's wrong with Cabe's water.
Gansey covered both his eyes with his hands. He thought his brain was going to melt. Ronan, however, was in no mood for introspection, his or anyone else's. He ripped Gansey's hands from his face.
Sit in it! Tell me it's any different!
He pushed Gansey down into the driver's seat and draped Gansey's lifeless arms over the steering wheel. He considered the image before him as if analyzing a museum piece. Then he reached in over the steering wheel and snatched a pair of sunglasses that were sitting on the dash. White, plastic, lenses dark as hell. Joseph Kavinsky's, or maybe a copy. Who was to say what was real anymore? Ronan put the white sunglasses onto Gansey's face and regarded him once more. His face went somber for half a second, and then it dissolved into an absolutely wonderful and fearless laugh. The old Ronan Lynch's laugh. No, it was better than that one, because this new one had just a hint of darkness beneath it. This Ronan knew there was crap in the world, but he was laughing anyway. Gansey couldn't help laughing along, rather more breathless. Somehow he had gone from such a terrible place to such a joyful one. He wasn't sure that the feeling would be so profound if he hadn't braced every bone in his body for an argument with Ronan. Okay, he said. Okay, tell me, Ronan told him.
Kavinsky?
Ronan explained. Gansey rested his cheek against the hot steering wheel. That, too, was comforting. He should have never gone without this car. He was never getting out of it again. Joseph Kavinsky. Unbelievable. And what's wrong with Cabe's water? Ronan shielded his eyes.
Me. Well, Kavinsky, actually. We're taking all the energy from the line when we dream.
Solution?
Stop Kavinsky.
They eyed each other. I don't suppose, Gansey said slowly, that we could just ask him nicely.
Hey, Churchill tried to negotiate with Hitler.
Gansey frowned. Did he?
Probably.
Letting out a huge breath, Gansey closed his eyes and let the steering wheel cook his face. This was home. Henrietta. The pig. Ronan. Nearly. His thoughts darted toward Adam, toward Blue, and rabbited away.
How was your party, man?
Ronan asked, kicking Gansey's knee through the open door.
How did Parrish do?
Gansey opened his eyes. Oh, he brought down the house. 48. At about the same time that Gansey was donning a pair of white sunglasses, Blue biked two neighborhoods over from her house. She carried the Camaro wheel, the shield boss, and a small pink switchblade. She was decidedly uncomfortable with the switchblade. Although she very much liked the idea of it, Blue Sergeant Desperado, Blue Sergeant Superhero, Blue Sergeant Badass, she suspected that the only thing she would cut the first time she opened it was herself, but Mora had insisted. Switchblades are illegal, Blue protested. So's crime, Mora replied. crime was all the papers, yes, papers plural, because against all reason Henrietta had two of them, could talk about. All over town, increasingly fearful citizens reported break-ins. The accounts were conflicting, however. Some said they had seen a single man, others two men, and still others said gangs of five or six. That means none of them are true, Blue said scathingly. She was skeptical of mainstream journalism. Or all of them, Mora replied. Did your hitman boyfriend tell you that? Mora said, he's not my boyfriend. By the time Blue parked her bike outside the Rambler where Calla took boxing lessons, she was feeling sticky and unappealing. The shaded lawn had no effect at all as she trudged across it to the door and rang the bell with her elbow. Hello, lady, said Mike, the enormous man who taught Calla. He was as wide as Blue was tall, which in all fairness was not very wide. Is that off a Corvette? Blue readjusted the pitted wheel beneath her arm. Camaro. What year? 1973. Oh, big block. 350? Sure. Nice, lady. Where's the rest of it? Out having a grand old time without me. Is Calla still here? Mike opened the door wider to admit Blue. She's just cooling down in the basement. Blue found Calla lying on the worn gray carpet in the basement, a generous and out-of-breath mountain of psychic. There were an astonishing number of punching bags hanging and stacked. Blue placed the Camaro wheel on Calla's heaving stomach. Do your magic trick, she ordered. How rude! But Calla reached up to fold her hands over the top of the pocked metal. Her eyes were closed, so she couldn't know what it was, but she said, he's not alone when he leaves the car behind. There was something chilling about the phrase, leaves behind. It could have just meant parked the car, but it didn't sound like that when Calla said it. It sounded like a synonym for abandon. And it seemed like it would take something pretty momentous to make Ganzi abandon the pig. When does it happen? It already has, Calla replied. Her eyes opened and fixed on Blue. And it hasn't. Yet. Time circular, chicken. We use the same parts of it over and over. Some of us more than others. Wouldn't we remember that? I said time was circular, Calla replied. I didn't say memories were. You're being creepy, Blue said. Maybe you mean to be, but in case you're just being accidentally creepy, I thought I'd let you know. You're the one dealing with creepy things, running with people who use time more than once. Blue thought about how Ganzi had cheated death on the ley line and how he seemed to be old and young at the same time. Ganzi? Glendower. Hand me that other thing you've got there. Blue traded the wheel for the shield boss. Calla held it for a long while. Then she sat up and reached for Blue's hand. She began to hum a little as she ran her fingers over the ravens on the boss. It was an archaic, haunted sort of tune, and it made Blue clasp her free arm around herself. They were dragging him at this point, Calla said. The horses had died. The men were very weak. It wouldn't stop raining. They meant to bury this with him, but it was too heavy. They left it behind. Left it behind. The echo felt deliberate. Ganzi would not abandon the Camaro unless he was under duress. Glendower's men wouldn't abandon his shield without similar distress. But it is Glendower's. Is he close? Blue felt a little kick to her heart. Close and far is like already happened and not happened yet, Calla replied. Blue tired of the enigmatic psychic talk, she insisted, but they had no horses, so it's only as far as they could go on foot. People, Calla said, can walk a long way if they have to. She got up and returned the shield boss to Blue. She smelled like she'd been boxing. She sighed very noisily. Calla? Blue asked suddenly. Are you one of those people who reuses time? You and Mom and Persephone? By way of answer, Calla answered, have you ever felt like there's something different about you? Like there is something more? Blue's heart jumped inside her again. Yes! Calla removed the keys to the Foxway car from her pocket. Good. Everyone should feel that way. Here,
Take these. You're driving home. You need the practice.
Blue could get nothing more out of her.
They bade Mike farewell. Don't drive that wheel too fast now.
Put Blue's bike in the trunk and drove rather slowly home. As Blue attempted to park in front of the house without hitting a small three-colored car already parked on the curb, Calla clucked.
Well, she remarked, trouble looks good today.
This was because Adam Parrish was waiting on their front step. 49. Adam sat awkwardly on the edge of Blue's bed. It felt strange to have so easily gained access to a girl's bedroom. If you knew Blue at all, the room was unsurprising. Canvas silhouettes of trees stuck to the walls, leaves hanging in chains from the ceiling fan, a bird with a talk bubble reading, "Worms for All," painted above a shelf cluttered with buttons and about 9 different pairs of scissors. Against the wall, Blue self-consciously taped up the drooping branch on one of the trees. No time. No time. He squeezed his eyes shut for just a second. He waited for her to stop messing over the trees so they could talk. She kept fiddling. He felt his pulse simmering inside him. He stood up. He couldn't sit any longer. Blue stopped abruptly. She leaned on her hands against the wall, expression watchful. Adam had intended to begin the conversation with a persuasive statement on why Gansey's conservative approach to the quest was wrong, but that wasn't what he said. Instead, he said, "I want to know why you won't kiss me, and I don't want to lie this time." There was silence. A rotating fan in the corner moved over both of them. The tips of the branches fluttered. The leaves spiraled. Blue demanded, "That's what you came here for?" She was mad. Adam was glad of it. It was worse to be the only person angry. When he didn't answer, she kept going, voice ever angrier. "That's the first conversation you want to have after coming back from D.C.? What does it matter where I came from? Because if I was Ronan or Noah, we'd be talking about how the party went. We'd be talking about where you disappeared to and what you wanted to do about that, and I don't know, real things. Not whether or not you got to kiss me." Adam thought it was the most irrelevant response ever, and she still hadn't answered his question. "Ronan and Noah aren't my girlfriend." "Girlfriend?" Blue repeated, and he felt a disconnected thrill to hear her say the word. "How about friend, friend?" "I thought we were friend, friends."
"Are we? Friends talk. You go walking to the Pentagon, and I find out from Gansey. Your dad's a jerk, and I find out from Gansey. Noah knows everything. Ronan knows everything."
"They don't know everything. They know what they were there for. Gansey knows because he was there."
"Yeah, and why wasn't I?"
"Why would you be?"
"Because you'd invited me,"
Blue said. The world tilted. He blinked. It straightened. "But there wasn't any reason for you to be there."
"Right, sure. Because there's no girls in politics. I have no interest. Voting? What? I forgot my apron. I think I ought to be in the kitchen right now, actually. My rolling pin.
I didn't know that you..."
"That's my point. Did it even occur to you?"
"It had not."
"You wouldn't have gone someplace without Gansey, though," Blue snapped. "You two make a grand couple. Kiss him."
Adam cocked his head witheringly.
"Well, I don't want to be just someone to kiss. I want to be a real friend, too. Not just someone who's fun to have around because I have breasts."
She didn't generally swear, but breasts felt as close to swearing as Adam could imagine at that moment. The combination of breasts and the morphing of the conversation annoyed him. "Nice, Blue. Gansey was right. You really can be a raging feminist." Blue sealed her mouth. Her shoulders trembled slightly, not like fear, but like the tremors before an earthquake. He shot out,
"You still didn't answer my question. Nothing of what you just said actually has any bearing on us."
Her lips made a sour shape.
"You want the truth?"
"It's what I wanted at the beginning of all this," Adam said, even though he didn't actually know what he wanted from her anymore. He wanted this fight to be done. He wished he hadn't come. He wished he'd asked her about Glendower instead. He wished he'd thought to ask her to the party. How could he have?
His head was too full, too empty, too askew. He'd walked too far out right past solid ground, but he couldn't seem to turn around. Right. The truth. She balled her fists and crossed her arms. Here it is. I've been told by psychics my whole life that if I kiss my true love, I'll kill him. There it is. Are you happy? I didn't tell you right away because I didn't want to say true love and scare you off. The trees wobbled behind her. Another vision was trying to manifest. He tried to untangle himself from it to sift his memories, trying to coordinate their near kisses with her confession of this deadly prophecy. It didn't feel real, but nothing did. And now? I don't know you, Adam. That's not your fault, whispered the air. You are unknowable. And now? 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 Finally, Blue's voice shook a little. I didn't tell you until just now, because I realized it didn't matter, because it's not going to be you. He felt it like one of his father's punches. A moment of deadness, and then blood rushing to the point of contact. And then it wasn't sadness, but the now familiar heat. It tore through him like an explosion, busting windows and devouring everything in an instantaneous blast. In slow motion, he could imagine the swing of his hand. No. No. He'd done this before with her, and he wasn't doing it again. He spun away, one fist on his forehead. With the other, he struck the wall, but not hard, just like he was grounding himself, discharging. He tore apart the anger, limb from limb, focused on the burning, terrible fire in his chest until it went out. It's not gonna be you. And at the end, all that was left was this. I want to leave. There had to be some other place he hadn't been yet. Some soil where this emotion wouldn't thrive. When he turned back around, she was motionless, watching him. When she blinked, two tears appeared like magic on her cheeks. The fast tears, the ones that were in your eyes and down your chin before you realized you were crying. Adam knew about those. Is that the truth? He asked. He asked it so quietly that the words came out gravelly, like a violin played too softly. Two more tears had queued up, but when she blinked, they remained in her eyes, shining little lakes. Not you. Not him, with his shabby anger, his long silences, his brokenness. Not you. Look at you, Adam, Gansey's voice said. Just look. Not you. Prove it, he whispered. What? Louder. Prove it. She started shaking her head. If it's not me, it's not going to do anything, is it? She shook her head harder. No, Adam. Louder. If it's not going to be me, Blue, it doesn't matter, does it? That's what you said. It's never going to be me. Miserably, she said, I don't want to hurt you, Adam. Either it's the truth or it's not. Blue put a hand on his chest and pressed. I don't want to kiss you. It's not going to be you and me. Not you. Since the last time his father had hit him, Adam's left ear had been dead and unresponsive. No hissing, no static, just the absence of sensation. That was how his entire body felt now. Okay, he said, voice colorless. Blue wiped her eyes with the back of her hand. I'm sorry, I really am. Okay. Feeling was coming back, but it was unfocused and dull, shimmering and fuzzy. It wasn't going to be him and her. It wasn't going to be him and Gansey. There was no more not here, not now. It was here. It was now. It was just going to be him and Cabe's water. I am unknowable. He was going down the stairs, though he didn't remember leaving Blue's room. Had he said anything? He was just going. He didn't know where. Voices and images flickered around him, pressing crookedly. One voice cut through the dissonance. It was the quietest in the house.
Adam,
Persephone said, catching his sleeve as he opened the front door.
It's time for us to talk.
50. Persephone gave him pie. It was pecan, and she had made it, and his taking it wasn't presented as an option. Mora frowned at him. Are you sure this is the right way, P? I guess you know best.
Sometimes, Persephone admitted. Come on, Adam. We're going to the reading room. Blue can come in with you, but it will be very personal.
He hadn't realized Blue was there. He kept his head down. There was a scuff on his hand from his walk down the interstate, and he worried silently at the skin at the edges. Blue said, What's happening? Persephone flapped a hand as if it was too difficult for her to explain. Mora said, She's balancing his insides with his outsides, making peace with Cabe's water, yes? Persephone nodded.
Close enough.
Blue said, I'll come with if you want me to. All faces swung toward him. If he went in by himself, it was nothing but this, Adam Parrish. In a way, it had always been that. Sometimes the scenery changed, sometimes the weather was better. But in the end, all he had was this, Adam Parrish. He made it easier to accept by telling himself again, it's just a reading room. He knew it was not the truth, but it was shaped like the truth. I'd like to do it by myself, he said in a low voice. He didn't look at her. Persephone stood up.
Bring your pie.
Adam brought his pie. The reading room was darker than the rest of the house, lit only by blocky candles congregated in the center of the reading table. Adam set the plate on the table. Persephone closed the doors behind her.
Take a bite of pie.
Adam took a bite of pie. The world focused just a little bit. With the doors shut, the room smelled like roses after dark and a match just blown out. And with the lights off, it was strangely difficult to tell how large the room was. Even though Adam knew full well the tiny dimensions of the room, it felt massive now, like an underground cavern. The walls seemed distant and uneven, the space swallowing the sounds of their breathing and the movement of the cards. Adam thought, I could stop now. But it was only the reading room. This was only a room that should have been a dining room. Nothing was going to change in here. Adam knew that none of these things was true, but it was easier to pretend that they were. Persephone selected a frame from the wall. Adam just had time to see that it was a photograph of a standing stone in a ragged field, and then she set it glass up on the table in front of him. In the dark and candlelight, the image disappeared. All that was visible was the reflection off the glass. It was suddenly a rectangle pool or mirror. The candlelight twirled and spun in the glass, not quite like the candlelight in reality. His stomach surged.
You must feel it, Persephone said, on the other side of the table. She did not sit. How out of balance you are.
It was too obvious to agree to. He pointed to the glass with its faulty reflections. What is that for?
Scrying, she replied. It's a way of looking other places. Places that are too far away to see, or places that only sort of exist, or places that don't want to be seen.
Adam thought he saw smoke spiral up against the glass. He blinked, gone. His hand smarted. Where are we looking?
Someplace very far away, Persephone said. She smiled at him.
It was a tiny, secretive thing, like a bird peering from branches.
Inside you.
Is it safe?
It's the opposite of safe, Persephone said. In fact, you'd better have another bite of pie.
Adam took a bite of pie. What will happen if I don't do it?
What you're feeling will only get worse. You can't really do the edge pieces first on this puzzle.
But if I do it, Adam started, then stopped, because the truth bit and burrowed and fit inside him. I'll be changed forever. She tilted her head sympathetically.
You've already changed yourself when you made the sacrifice. This is just the end part of that.
Then there was no point not doing it. Tell me how to do it, then. Persephone leaned forward, but she still didn't sit.
You have to stop giving things away. You didn't sacrifice your mind. Start choosing to keep your thoughts your own, and remember your sacrifice, too. You need to mean it.
I did mean it, Adam said, anger rushing up, sudden and singing and pure. It was an undying enemy. She just blinked at him with her pure black eyes. His fury shriveled.
You promised to be Capeswater's hands and eyes, but have you been listening to what it's asked you for?
It hasn't said anything. Persephone's expression was knowing.
Of course it had.
All at once, he knew that that was the cause of the apparitions and half-visions. Capeswater had been trying to get his attention the only way it could. All of this noise, this sound, this chaos inside him, I couldn't understand.
It's out of balance too, she said, but that's a different ritual for a different problem. Now, look inside yourself. But know there are things in there that are hurtful. Scrying is never safe. You never know who you will meet.
He asked, will you help me if something goes wrong? Her black eyes held his. He understood. He'd left his only help outside in the kitchen.
Beware of anyone promising you help now, Persephone said. Inside yourself, it's only you who can help you.
They began. At first, he was aware only of the candles, the thin high flicker of the true candles, and the twisted circuitous burning of the candles in the mirrored glass. Then a drop of water seemed to plunge from the darkness above him. It should have splashed on the glass, but instead it pierced the surface easily. It landed in a tumbler of water, one of the chunky, cheap ones that used to fill his mother's cabinets. This one was in Adam's hand. Just as he was about to drink, he caught a flash of movement. He had no time to brace himself before light, sound, his father hit him. Wait, Adam said, explaining, always about to explain as he struck the faded counter of their kitchen. It should have been done by now, the punch, but he seemed to be trapped inside it. He was the boy, the blow, the counter, the flaring anger that drove it all. This lived in him. This punch, the first time his father had ever hit him, was always being thrown somewhere in his head. Capeswater, Adam thought. He was released from the punch. As the tumbler crashed on the floor, too sturdy to smash, the drop of water slid out and began to fall again. This time it plummeted into a still, mirrored pool surrounded by trees. Blackness crept between the trees, lush and dark and living. Adam had been here before. Capeswater. Was he really here? Or was it a dream? Did it make a difference to Capeswater? This place. He smelled the damp earth beneath fallen branches, heard the sound of insects working themselves under rotting bark, felt the same breeze touch his hair that breathed on the leaves overhead. In the night water at Adam's feet, red fish circled.
They mouthed the ripples where the droplet had broken the surface. The movement drew his eye to the dreaming tree on the opposite shore. It looked just as it had before, a massive old oak with a rotted cavern inside it, big enough to admit a person. Months ago, Adam had stood inside the tree and had a terrible vision of the future, Ganzi dying because of him. Adam heard a groan. It was the woman he'd seen in his apartment, the very first spirit. She wore a pale, old-fashioned dress. "Do you know what Cabeswater wants?" he asked. Leaning against the rugged bark of the dreaming tree, the woman pressed the back of her hand against her forehead in distress.
"Auli, Grey Warren, Fioris, Al, Lovine."
It wasn't Latin. Adam said, "I don't understand." Beside her suddenly was the man with the bowler hat, the one Adam had glimpsed at the Ganzi mansion. The man begged,
"Amy, Grey Warren, Fioris, Al."
"I'm sorry," Adam said. Another spirit appeared, hand outstretched to him, and another. All of the flashes he had seen, a dozen figures, incomprehensible. A small voice at his elbow said, "I will translate for you." He turned to see a small girl in a black frock. She was not unlike a miniature Persephone. Mountainous white hair, spun like cotton candy, narrow face, black eyes. She took his hand. Hers was very cold and a little damp. He shivered warily. "Will you translate truthfully?" Her tiny fingers were tight on his. He had not seen her before. He was certain. Of all the flashes and visions he'd had since making the sacrifice, she'd not been one of them. She was so like Persephone, but twisted. "No," he said. "I can only help myself." She tipped her head back angry.
"You're already dead in here."
Before he could pull away, she clawed her other hand down his wrist. Three sharp lines of blood welled up. He could taste it, like she had torn his tongue instead. It was like a bad dream. No, if this was like a dream, if Cabeswater was like a dream, it meant it was all in his control, if he chose it. Adam shook himself free. He wasn't going to give his mind away. "Cabeswater," he said out loud, "tell me what you need." He reached into the pool. It was cold and insubstantial, like sliding his hand against sheets. Carefully, he scooped out the single drop of water he'd followed into the vision. It tipped back and forth in his palm, rolling along his lifeline. He hesitated. On the other side of this moment, he knew there was something that would separate him from the others forever. How much, he didn't know, but he would have been somewhere they hadn't. He would be something they weren't. But he already was. And then he was in the drop of water. No longer did Cabeswater need to reach out to him through apparitions. He didn't need the clumsy flickers in his vision. No desperate pleas for his attention. He was Cabeswater. And he was the dreaming tree. And he was every oak with roots digging through rocks looking for energy and hope. He felt the suck and pulse of the ley line through him. What a crass, mundane term for it, ley line, now that he'd felt it. He could remember every other name for it now, and they all seemed more fitting. Fairy roads, spirit paths, song lines, the old tracks, dragon lines, dream paths. The corpse roads. The energy flickered and sputtered through him, less like electricity and more like remembering a secret. It was strong, all-encompassing, and then fading, waiting. Sometimes he was nothing but it, and sometimes it was nearly forgotten. And beneath it all, he felt the oldness of Cabeswater, the strangeness. There was something true and inhuman at its core. It had been there so many centuries before him, and it would exist for centuries after.
In the relative scheme of things, Adam Parrish was irrelevant. He was such a small thing, just a whorl in the fingerprint of a massive being. I didn't agree to give my thoughts away. He would be Caveswater's hands and Caveswater's eyes, but he wouldn't be Caveswater. He would be Adam Parrish. He sat back. He was in the reading room. A drop of water sat on top of the framed photograph. Across from him, Persephone dabbed three bloody scratches on her wrist. Her sleeve had been ripped through. Everything in the room looked different to Adam. He just wasn't sure how. It was like he'd adjusted the aspect on his television from widescreen to normal. He didn't know how he'd thought before that Persephone's eyes were black. Every color combined to make black.
They won't understand, Persephone said.
She laid her deck of tarot cards on the table in front of him.
They didn't when I came back.
Am I different? He asked.
You were different before, Persephone replied. But now they won't be able to stop noticing.
Adam touched the tarot cards. It seemed a very long time ago that he'd looked at the deck on the table. What am I supposed to do with them?
Knock on them, she whispered. Three times. They like that. Then shuffle them, and then hold them to your heart.
He softly rapped his knuckles on the deck, shuffled the cards, and then grasped the oversized deck. When he held it to his chest, the cards felt warm like a living creature. They hadn't felt like that before.
Now ask them a question.
Adam closed his eyes. What now?
Put down four of them, Persephone said. No, three. Three. Past, present, future. Face up.
Carefully, Adam laid three cards on the table. The art in Persephone's deck was dark, smudgy, barely visible in this dim light. The figures on them seemed to move. He read the words at the bottom of each. The Tower. The Hanged Man. Nine of Swords. Persephone pursed her lips. Adam's eyes drifted from the first card, where men fell from a burning tower, to the second, where a man hung upside down from a tree, and then to the last, where a man wept into his hands. That third card, that utter despair, he couldn't take his gaze from it. Adam said, "It looks like he's woken from a nightmare." It looks, he thought, like I will, if the vision from the dreaming tree comes true. When Adam lifted his eyes to Persephone, he was certain she was seeing the same things he was seeing. He could tell from the flattening of her lips, the remorse in her eyes. The room stretched out around them, black and limitless. A cave or an old forest or a flat mirror-black lake. The future kept being a something Adam was thrown into, a quest, a sacrifice, the dead face of a best friend. No, Adam said softly. Persephone echoed.
No.
No, he shook his head. Maybe this is the future, but it's not the end. Persephone said,
Are you sure?
There was a note to her voice that hadn't been there before. Adam thought about it. He thought about the warm feeling to the deck of cards and how he'd asked that question, what now? And they had given him this terrible answer. He thought about how he could still hear the sound of Persephone's voice echoing all around him, although it should have disappeared into the close walls of this reading room. He thought about how he had been Caveswater and felt the corpse road snaking through him. He said, I am. I'm pulling another card. He hesitated, waiting for her to tell him it wasn't allowed, but she just waited. Adam cut the deck, laid his hand on each stack. He took the card that felt warmer. Flipping it, he placed the card beside the Nine of Swords. A robed figure stood before a coin, a goblet, a sword, a wand, all of the symbols of all the tarot suits. An infinity symbol floated above his head. One arm was lifted in a posture of power. Yes, thought Adam. Understanding prickled and then evaded him. He read the words at the bottom of the card. The magician. Persephone let out a long, long breath and began to laugh. It was a relieved laugh that sounded as if she'd been running.
Adam, she said, finish your pie.
51. Blue had indeed cut herself. After Adam had gone into the reading room, she'd experimentally opened the switchblade, and it had obligingly attacked her. It was just a scratch, really. It barely warranted a band-aid, but she put one on anyway. She did not feel like Blue Sergeant Superhero, or Blue Sergeant Desperado, or Blue Sergeant Badass. Maybe she shouldn't have told the truth. Even though it had been hours since the fight, her heart still felt jittery, like it wasn't attached to anything, and every time it beat, it rattled around in her chest cavity. She kept replaying their words. She shouldn't have lost her temper. She should have told him at the very beginning. She should have... anything but how it happened. Why couldn't I have fallen in love with him? He was sleeping now, thrown across the couch, lips parted in unself-conscious exhaustion. Persephone had informed Blue that she expected him to sleep for 16 to 18 hours after the ritual, and that he might experience light nausea or vomiting once he woke. Mora, Persephone, and Calla sat at the kitchen table, heads together, debating. Every so often, Blue heard snatches of conversation. Should have done it sooner, and... but he needed to accept it. She looked at him again. He was handsome, and he liked her. And if she hadn't told him the truth, she could have dated him like a normal girl and even kissed him without worrying about killing him. Blue stood by the front door, her head leaning against the wall. But she didn't want that. She wanted something more. Maybe there is nothing else. Maybe she'd go for a walk, just her and the pink switchblade. They were a good pair, both incapable of opening up without cutting someone. She didn't know where she'd go, though. She crept up to the reading room quietly so that she wouldn't wake Adam or alert Orla. Picking up the phone, she listened to make sure no one was having a psychic experience on the other end. Dial tone. She called Ganzi. Blue, he said. Just his voice. Her heart tethered itself. Not completely, but enough to stop quivering so much. She closed her eyes. Take me somewhere? They took the newly minted pig, which indeed seemed identical to the last one, down to the odor of gasoline and the coughing start of the engine. The passenger seat was the same busted vinyl bucket it had been before, and the headlights on the road ahead were the same twin beams of weak golden light. But Ganzi was different. Though he wore his usual khakis and stupid topsiders, he was wearing a white collarless t-shirt and his wire-frame glasses. This was her favorite Ganzi, the scholar Ganzi, not a hint of Aglimby about him. There was something terrible about how this Ganzi made her feel at the moment, though. When she got in, he asked, "What happened, Jane?" "Adam and I fought," she said. "I told him. I don't want to talk about it." He put the car in gear. "Do you want to talk at all?" "Only if it isn't about him." "Do you know where you want to go?" "Someplace that isn't here." So he drove them out of town, and he told her about Ronan and Kavinsky. When he'd done with that, he kept driving into the mountains, onto ever more narrow roads, and he told her about the party and the book club and organic cucumber sandwiches. The Camaro's engine growled, echoing up the steep bank beside the road. The headlights only illuminated as far as the next turn. Blue pulled her legs up and wrapped her arms around them. Resting her cheek on her knees, she watched Ganzi switch gears and glance in his rearview mirror and then at her. He told her about the pigeons, and he told her about Helen. He told her about everything except for Adam. It was like describing a circle without ever saying the word. "Okay," she said finally.
You can talk about him now. There was silence in the car. Well, less sound. The engine roared and the anemic air conditioning blew fitful breaths over them both. Oh, Jane, he said suddenly. If you'd been there when we got the call about him walking on the interstate, you would have... He trailed off before she found out what she would have done. And then all of a sudden, he pulled himself together.
Ha! Adam's communing with trees, and Noah keeps reenacting being murdered, and Ronan's wrecking and then making me new cars. What's new with you? Something terrible, I trust?
You know me, Blue said, ever sensible.
Like myself, Gansey agreed grandly, and she laughed delightedly. A creature of simple delights.
Blue touched the radio knob, but she didn't turn it. She dropped her fingers. I feel terrible about what I said to him.
Gansey guided the pig up an even more narrow road. It might have been someone's driveway. It was difficult to tell in these mountains, especially after dark. The insects in the close-pressed trees trilled even louder than the engine.
Adam has killed himself for Aglenby, he said suddenly. And for what? Education?
No one went to Aglenby for education.
Not just that, she said. Prestige? Opportunity?
But maybe he never had a chance. Maybe success is in your genes.
Something more. This really isn't a conversation I feel like having right now.
What? Oh, that is not what I meant. I mean that I'm rich.
Not helping.
I'm rich in support.
So are you. You grew up loved, didn't you?
She didn't even have to think before she nodded.
Me too, Gansey said. I never doubted it. I never even thought to doubt it. And even Ronan grew up with that too, back when it mattered, when he was becoming the person he was, the age of reason or whatever. I wish you could have met him before. But growing up being told you can do anything... I used to think, before I met you, that it was about the money, like I thought Adam's family was too poor for love.
Oh, but since we're poor but happy, started Blue hotly, the cheerful peasants...
Don't, please, Jane, he interrupted. You know what I mean. I'm telling you I was stupid over it. I thought it was about trying so hard to survive that you didn't have the time to be a good parent. Obviously, that's not it. Because you and I, we're both wealthy in love.
I suppose, Blue said, but that's not going to get me into community college. Community college? Gansey echoed. His shocked emphasis on community hurt Blue more than she could admit out loud. She sat quietly and miserably in the passenger seat until he glanced over.
Surely you can get scholarships. They don't cover books. That's only a few $100 a semester, right? Just how much do you think I make at a shift at Nino's, Gansey?
Don't they make grants to cover that? Frustration welled in her. Everything that had happened that day felt ready to explode out of her.
Either I'm an idiot or I'm not, Gansey. Make up your mind. Either I'm clever enough to have researched this myself and be eligible for a scholarship, or I am too stupid to have considered the options and I can't get a scholarship anyway.
Please don't be angry. She rested her head on the door.
Sorry.
Jesus, Gansey said. I wish this week was over.
For a few minutes, they drove in silence.
Up, up, up.
Blue asked, did you ever meet his parents? In a low, unfamiliar voice, he said, I hate them. And a little bit later, the bruises he'd come to school with. Who has he ever had to love him? Ever. In her mind, Adam pressed that fist against her bedroom wall so gently, though every muscle was knotted, wanting to destroy it. She said, look there. Gansey followed her gaze. The trees on one side of the road had fallen away, and suddenly they could see that the little gravel track they were on clung to the very side of the mountain, winding up like tinsel. All of the valley suddenly spread out below. Though hundreds of stars were already visible, the sky was still a deep blue, a whimsical touch from an idealistic painter. The mountains on the other side of the valley, however, were night black. Everything the sky was not, dark and cool and silent. And between them, at the mountain's feet, was Henrietta itself, studded with yellow and white lights. Gansey let the pig slide to a stop. He stepped on the parking brake. They both gazed out the driver's side window. It was a sort of ferocious, quiet beauty, the sort that wouldn't let you admire it, the sort of beauty that just always hurt. Gansey sighed, small and quiet and ragged, like he hadn't meant to let it escape. She shifted her gaze from the window to the side of his head, watching him watch instead. He pressed his thumb against his lower lip. This was Gansey, that gesture. And then he swallowed. It was, she thought, just as she felt when she looked at the stars, when she walked in Caveswater. "What are you thinking?" Blue asked. He didn't answer right away. Then when he did, he kept his eyes trained on the view. "I've been all over the world. More than one country for every year that I'm alive. Europe and South America and the highest mountains and the widest rivers and the prettiest villages. I'm not saying that to show off. I'm just saying it because I'm trying to understand how I could have been so many places, and yet this is the only place that feels like home. This is the only place I belong. And because I'm trying to understand how, if I belong here, it hurts so much," Blue finished. Gansey turned to her, his eyes bright. He just nodded. "Why," she thought, agonized, "couldn't it have been Adam?" She said, "If you find out, will you tell me?" "He's going to die, Blue. Don't." "I don't know if we're meant to find out," he said. "Oh, we're finding out," Blue said with extra ferocity, trying to tamp down the feeling rising in her. "If you're not going to, I'll do it myself." He said, "If you find out first, will you tell me?" "Sure thing." "Jane, in this light," he started, "you... Jesus. Jesus. I've got to get my head straight." He suddenly threw open the door and got out, seizing the roof to pull himself out faster. He slammed the door and then walked around the back of the car, one hand scrubbed through his hair. The car was utterly quiet. She heard the buzzing of night insects and singing of frogs and slow chirps of birds who should have known better. Every so often, the cooling engine let out a little sigh like a breath. Gansey didn't return. Fumbling in the dark, she pushed open her door. She found him leaning against the back of the car, arms crossed over his chest. "I'm sorry," Gansey said, not looking at her as she leaned on the car beside him. "That was very rude." Blue thought of a few things to reply, but couldn't say any of them out loud. She felt like one of the night birds had gotten inside her. It tumbled and fumbled every time she breathed. "He's going to die. This is going to hurt." But she touched his neck, right where his hair was cut evenly above the collar of his shirt. He was very still. His skin was hot, and she could very, very faintly feel his pulse beneath her thumb. It wasn't like when she was with Adam. She didn't have to guess what to do with her hands. They knew. This was what it should have felt like with Adam. Less like play-acting and more like a foregone conclusion. He closed his eyes and leaned, just a little, so that her palm was flat on his neck, fingers sprawled from his ear to his shoulder. Everything in Blue was charged. "Say something. Say something." Gansey lifted her hand gently from his skin, holding it as formally as a dance. He put it against his mouth. Blue froze, absolutely still. Her heart didn't beat. She didn't blink. She couldn't say, "Don't kiss me." She couldn't even form, "Don't." He just leaned his cheek and the edge of his mouth against her knuckles and then set her hand back. "I know," he said. "I wouldn't." Her skin burned with the memory of his mouth. The thrashing bird of her heart shivered and shivered again. Thanks for remembering. He looked back over the valley. Oh, Jane. Oh, Jane, what? He didn't want me to, did you know? He told me not to try to get you to come to the table that night at Nino's. I had to talk him into it, and then I made such an idiot of myself. He turned back to her. What are you thinking? She just looked at him. That I went out with the wrong boy. That I destroyed Adam tonight for no reason at all. That I'm not sensible at all. I thought you were an asshole. Gallantly, he said, thank God for past tense. Then, I can't. We can't do this to him. It was jagged inside her. I'm not a thing to have. No, Jesus, of course you're not. But you know what I mean. She did, and he was right. They couldn't do this to him. She shouldn't do it to herself anyway. But how it made a disaster of her chest and her mouth and her head. I wish you could be kissed, Jane, he said, because I would beg just one off you. Under all this, he flailed an arm toward the stars. And then we'd never say anything about it again. That could have been the end of it. I want something more, she said. We can pretend just once, and then we'll never say anything about it again. What a strange, shifting person he was. The Gansey who turned to her now was a world away from the lofty boy she'd first met. Without any hesitation, she stretched her arms around his neck. Who was this Blue? She felt bigger than her body, high as the stars. He leaned toward her, her heart spun again, and pressed his cheek against hers. His lips didn't touch her skin, but she felt his breath, hot and uneven on her face. His fingers splayed on either side of her spine. Her lips were so close to his jaw that she felt his hint of stubble at the end of them. It was mint and memories, and the past and the future, and she felt as if she'd done this before, and already she longed to do it again. Oh, help, she thought. Help, help, help. He pulled away. He said, and now we never speak of it again. 52. That night after Gansey had gone to meet Blue, Ronan retrieved one of Kavinsky's green pills from his still unwashed pair of jeans and returned to bed. Propped up in the corner, he stretched out his hand to Chainsaw, but she ignored him. She had stolen a cheese cracker and now was very busily stacking things on top of it to make sure Ronan would never take it back. Although she kept glancing back at his outstretched hand, she pretended not to see it as she added a bottle cap, an envelope, and a sock to the pile hiding the cracker. Chainsaw, he said, not sharply, but like he meant it. Recognizing his tone, she soared to the bed. She didn't generally enjoy petting, but she turned her head left and right as Ronan softly traced the small feathers on either side of her beak. How much energy had it taken from the ley line to create her, he wondered. Was it more to take out a person? A car? Ronan's phone buzzed. He tilted it to read the incoming text. Your mom calls me after we spend the day together. Ronan let the phone fall back to the bedspread. Ordinarily, seeing Kavinsky's name light up his phone gave him a strange sense of urgency, but not tonight. Not after spending so many hours with him. Not after dreaming the Camaro. He needed to process all of this first. Ask me what my first dream was. Chainsaw pecked irritably at the buzzing phone. She'd learned a lot from Ronan. He rolled the green pill in his hand. He wouldn't take anything out of his dreams tonight, not knowing what they were doing to the ley line. But it didn't mean he couldn't still choose what to dream of. My favorite forgery is Prokopenko. Ronan put the pill back in his pocket. He felt warm and sleepy and just fine. For once, he felt fine. Sleep didn't feel like a weapon tucked inside his brain. He knew he could choose to dream of the barns now if he tried, but he didn't want to dream of something that existed in this world. I'm going to eat you alive, man. Ronan closed his eyes. He thought, my father, my father, my father.
and when he opened his eyes again, the old trees roamed upward all around him. The sky was black and star-full overhead. Everything smelled of hickory smoke and boxwood, grass seed and lemon cleaner. And there was his father, sitting in the charcoal BMW he had dreamt all those years ago. He was an image of Ronan, and also of Declan, and also of Matthew, a handsome devil with one eye the color of a promise and the other the color of a secret. When he saw Ronan, he rolled down the window. "Ronan," he said. It sounded like he meant to say, "Finally." "Dad," Ronan said. He was going to say, "I missed you." But he had been missing Neil Lynch for as long as he knew him. A grin cracked over his father's face. He had the widest smile in the world, and he'd given it to his youngest son. "You figured it out," he said. He held a finger to his lips. "Remember." Music wafted out the open window of the BMW that had been Neil Lynch's but was now Ronan's. A soaring bit of tune played by the Iliad pipes dissipating into the trees. "I know," Ronan replied. "Tell me what you meant in the will." His father said, "Ti libre, ve roabar, nivo libre nacre." "This will stands as fact unless a newer document is created." "It's a loophole," his father said. "A loophole for thieves." "Is that a lie?" Ronan asked. Because Neil Lynch was the biggest liar of them all, and he'd stuffed all of that into his eldest son. There was not much difference between a lie and a secret. "I never lie to you." His father started the BMW and flashed his slow smile at Ronan. What a grin he had. What ferocious eyes. What a creature he was. He had dreamt himself an entire life and death. Ronan said, "I want to go back." "Then take it," said his father. "You know how now." And Ronan did, because Neil Lynch was a forest fire, a rising sea, a car crash, a closing curtain, a blistering symphony, a catalyst with planets inside him. And he had given all of that to his middle son. Neil Lynch reached his hand out. He clasped Ronan's in his own. The engine was revving. Even while holding Ronan's hand, his foot was already on the gas pedal, on the way to the next place. "Ronan," he said, and it sounded like he meant to say, "Wake up." After the house had gone quiet, Blue got into bed and pulled the blanket over her face. Sleep was nowhere. Her mind was full of Adam's dull expression, Ronan's invented Camaro, and Gansey's breath on her cheek. Her mind took the memory of Mint and spun it into a related memory of him, one that Gansey didn't have yet, the first time she'd ever seen him. Not at Nino's when he asked her out on Adam's behalf, but that night in the churchyard when all of the spirits of the future dead walked past. 1 year. That was the longest that any of those spirits had. They would all be dead before the next St. Mark's Eve. She had seen her first spirit, a boy in an Aglimby sweater, the shoulders of it spattered darkly with rain. "What's your name?" "Gansey." She couldn't make it untrue. Downstairs, Calla's voice suddenly swelled angrily. "Well, I will break the damn thing myself if I find you using it again." "Tyrant," Mora shot back. Persephone's voice murmured amiably, too low for eavesdropping. Blue closed her eyes tight. She saw Gansey's spirit, one hand braced in the dirt. She felt his breath, his hands pressed into her back. Sleep didn't come. A few amorphous minutes later, Mora knocked the pads of her fingers on Blue's open door. "Sleeping?" "Always," Blue replied. Her mother climbed into Blue's narrow bed. She jerked at the pillow until Blue allowed her a few inches of it. Then she lay down behind Blue, mother and daughter like spoons in a drawer. Blue closed her eyes again, inhaling the soft clove scent of her mother and the fading mint of Gansey.
After a moment, Mora asked, "Are you crying?" "Only a little."
"Why?"
"Generalized sadness."
"Are you sad? Did something bad happen?"
"Not yet."
"Ah, Blue."
Her mother wrapped her arms around her and breathed into the hair at the base of Blue's neck. Blue thought about what Gansey had said about being wealthy in love, and she thought about Adam, still collapsed on their sofa downstairs. If he had no one to wrap their arms around him when he was sad, could he be forgiven for letting his anger lead him? Blue asked, "Are you crying?" "Only a little," her mother said, and inhaled snottily and unbecomingly.
"Why?"
"Generalized sadness."
"Are you sad? Did something bad happen?"
"Not yet.
A long time ago."
"Those are the opposite," Blue said. Mora sniffed again.
"Not really."
Blue wiped her eyes with her pillowcase. "Tears don't become us." Her mother wiped her eyes on the shoulder of Blue's t-shirt.
"You're right.
What becomes us?"
"Action."
Mora laughed softly under her breath.
How terrible it would be, Blue thought, her mind on Adam again, to not have a mother who loved you.
"Yes," she agreed. "How wise you are, Blue." On the other side of Henrietta, the gray man answered his phone. It was Greenmantle. Without any particular preamble, he said, "Dean Allen." The gray man, phone in one hand, book in the other, didn't immediately respond. He set his tattered edition of Anglo-Saxon riddles face down on the side table. The television prattled in the background. One spy met another on a bridge. They were exchanging hostages. They'd been told to come alone. They hadn't come along. It was taking an unexpectedly long period of time for the gray man to register the meaning of Greenmantle's words. Then, once that had sunk in, it took him even longer to understand why Greenmantle was saying them.
"That's right," Greenmantle said. "The mystery's gone."
It wasn't that hard to figure out who you were. Turns out, Anglo-Saxon poetry is a very small field, even at the undergrad level. And you know how well I do with undergrads. The gray man hadn't been Dean Allen for a very long time. It was harder than one might expect to abandon an identity, but the gray man was more patient and devoted than most. Usually one traded one identity for another, but the gray man wanted to be no one. Nowhere. He touched the weathered spine of the riddle book.
"Ich eom ratlik, witched on Shewin Sheopan."
Greenmantle added, "So I want it.
I am a beautiful thing shaped for fighting."
"I don't have it." "Sure, Dean, sure."
"Don't call me that." "Nelech. Unbunden, Nijum Hiran, Nymphe, Seoruslet."
"Why not? It's your name, isn't it?"
"Unstrung, I obey no man, only when skillfully tied."
The gray man said nothing. "So you're not going to change your story, Dean?" Greenmantle asked. "And yet you're going to keep taking my calls. So that means you know where it is, but you don't have it yet." For so many years, he'd buried that name. Dean Allen wasn't supposed to exist. There was a reason he'd given it up.
"Tell you what," Greenmantle said. "I tell you what. You get the Grey Worn and call me by the 4th of July with your flight confirmation number back here, or I tell your brother where you are."
"Hold still, Dean." Logic swam away from the gray man. Very quietly, he said, "I told you about him in confidence."
"I paid you in confidence. Turns out he's eager to know where you are," Greenmantle said. "We had a chat
Dean says he lost touch with you in the middle of a conversation he's been wanting to finish. The gray man turned off the television, but voices still hummed in the background. Dean, Green Mantle said, you there? No, not really. Color was draining from the walls. Do we have an agreement? No, not really. A weapon didn't come to an agreement with the hand that held it. 2 days is plenty of time, Dean, Greenmantle said. See you on the other side. 53. For 21 hours, Adam Parrish and the Gray Man slept. While they slept without dreaming, Henrietta prepared for the 4th of July. Flags climbed poles over car dealerships. Parade signs warned would-be parallel parkers to rethink their choices. In the suburbs, fireworks were bought and dreamt. Doors were locked and later busted open. At 300 Fox Way, Adam quietly turned 18. Calla was called into her office to make certain nothing important had been stolen during a break-in. At Monmouth Manufacturing, a white Mitsubishi with a set of keys in the ignition and a knife graphic on the side appeared in the parking lot overnight. It bore a note that read, "This one's for you, just the way you like it, fast and anonymous." Gansey frowned at the disordered handwriting. "I think he needs to come to terms with his sexuality." Ronan, chewing his leather bracelets, dropped them from his teeth and said, "There is no coming to terms with having 3 balls. It was the sort of joke he normally made for Noah, but Noah wasn't there. Back at the psychic's house, Adam woke up. According to Maura, he swung his legs over the sofa, walked into the kitchen where he drank 4 glasses of pomegranate juice and 3 cups of one of the more noxious healing teas, thanked Maura for the use of her couch, and then got into his tri-colored car and drove away, all within the space of 10 minutes. 15 minutes after that, Maura reported, Persephone came downstairs with a butterfly-shaped handbag and a pair of sensible boots with 3-inch heels and laces all the way up her thighs. A taxi arrived and she climbed into it. It drove away in the same direction as the tri-colored car. 12 minutes after that, Kavinsky texted Ronan, "Ball sack." Ronan replied, "Shit stack." Kavinsky, "Coming to 4th of July. Ronan, "Would you stop if you knew it was destroying the world?" Kavinsky, "God, that would be awesome." "Well," Gansey asked. Ronan said, "Wouldn't bet on the negotiations." 7 minutes after that, Maura, Calla, and Blue climbed into the fatigued Ford, drove to get Ronan and Gansey, and headed into the simmering day. Gansey looked like a king, even sitting in the shabby back seat of the shared Foxway vehicle. Perhaps especially when sitting in the back seat of a shabby vehicle. He asked, "What is it we're doing?" Maura replied, "Action." 54. "Why are we here, man?" Ronan asked. His eyes followed Chainsaw as she cantered anxiously across the counter. He'd brought her to enough places that new locations didn't generally faze her for long, but she wouldn't be truly happy until she'd done a perimeter search. She paused to tap her beak on an absolutely darling bird-themed cookie jar. "There are more goddamn roosters than a Hitchcock movie." "Are you referring to the birds?" Gansey asked, "because I don't recall any chickens in it. It's been a long time, though." They stood in a homey, below-ground kitchen in the basement of the Pleasant Valley Bed and Breakfast. Calla searched the cupboards and drawers, her version of Chainsaw's room check, possibly. She'd already discovered a waffle maker and a gun, and had placed both on the round breakfast table. Blue stood at the far doorway, peering around to where her mother had gone. Ronan assumed she and Gansey must have fought. She was as far away from him as she could get. Next to Ronan, Gansey reached up to brush one of the dark, exposed beams with his fingertips. He was clearly discomforted by what Maura had told him about Adam on the ride over. Ganseys were creatures of habit, and he wanted Adam here, and he wanted Noah here. and he wanted everyone to like him, and he wanted to be in charge. Ronan had no idea what he wanted. He checked his phone. He wondered if Kavinsky really did have three balls. He wondered if Kavinsky was gay. He wondered if he should go to the 4th of July party. He wondered where Adam had gone. "Lynch," Gansey said. "Are you even listening?" He glanced up. "No." On the counter, Chainsaw tore shreds from a roll of paper towels. Ronan snapped his fingers at her, and with an insolent gurgle, she flapped from the counter to the table, claws making a substantial scratch-click as she landed. Ronan was abruptly satisfied with her as a dream creature. He hadn't even asked for her. His subconscious had just, for once, sent him something nice instead of something homicidal. Gansey asked Calla, "Why are we here?" Calla echoed, "Yes, Mora, why are we here?" Mora had entered from the other room. Behind her, Ronan glimpsed the corner of a bed, a gray suitcase. There was a sound like pipes clanging, a tap running. She dusted off her palms and joined them in the kitchen. "Because when Mr. Gray comes out here, I want you to look him in the eye and convince him not to kidnap you." Gansey elbowed Ronan. Ronan looked up sharply. "What? Me?" "Yes, you," Mora said. "Mr. Gray was sent here to retrieve an object that lets the owner take things from dreams. The Gray Warren. As you know, that's you." He felt a little thrill at the word Gray Warren. "Yes, that's me," Calla added. "And unbelievably, it falls to your charm to convince him to have mercy on you." He smiled nastily at her. She smiled nastily back. Both smiles said, "I've got your number." There was no part of Ronan that was surprised by this news. Part of him, he realized, was surprised that it had taken so long. He felt he must have prompted it. He had been told not to go back to the barns, and he had. His father had told him not to tell anyone about his dreams, and he had. One by one, he was violating every rule in his life. Of course someone was looking. Of course they had found him. "He's not the only one looking," Blue said suddenly. "Is he? That's what all these break-ins are." Quite impossibly, she produced a pink switchblade to punctuate this statement. That little knife was the most shocking thing about the conversation so far. "I'm afraid so," Mora replied. "Burglars," Ronan thought, all at once. Gansey said, "Are the..." Ronan interrupted. "Is he the one who beat up my brother? I should buy him a card if he is." "Does it matter?" Mora asked, at about the same time that Calla asked. "Do you think your brother told anybody anything?" "I'm sure he did," Ronan said darkly. "But don't worry, none of it was true." Gansey took control. In his voice, Ronan could hear the relief that he knew enough about the situation to actually do so. He asked whether Mr. Gray really wanted to kidnap Ronan, whether his employer knew that the Gray Warren was definitely in Henrietta, whether the others wandering about knew. Finally, he asked, "What happens to Mr. Gray if he doesn't come back with something?" Mora pursed her lips. "Let's just use death as a short version of the consequences," Calla added. "But for decision-making purposes, assume it's worse than that," Blue muttered. "He can take Joseph Kavinsky." "If they take that other boy," Calla said, "they'll be back for the snake." This was said with a jerk of her chin toward Ronan. Then her eyes flickered up to Mora. The gray man stood in the doorway behind Mora, his gray suitcase in one hand and a gray jacket slung over the other. He set them both down and straightened. There was that heavy silence that sometimes happens when a hitman enters a room. It was against Ronan's nature to appear overly interested in anything, but he couldn't help staring at the gray man. It was the man from the barns, the man who'd taken the puzzle box. He would have never put the words hitman to him. To him, a hitman was something else. A bouncer, a bodybuilder, an action hero. This wary predator was none of those things. His build was unassuming, all sly kinetics, but his eyes. Ronan was suddenly afraid of him. He was afraid of him in the same way that he was afraid of the night horrors. because they had killed him before, and they would kill him again, and he precisely remembered the pain of each death. He felt the fear in his chest, and in his face, and in the back of his head, sharp and stinging like a tire iron. Chainsaw scrambled to Ronan's shoulder and ducked low, eyes on the gray man. She cawed stridently, just once. For his part, the gray man stared back, his expression guarded. The longer he looked at Ronan and Chainsaw, the more his eyebrows furrowed, and the longer he looked, the closer Gansey edged to Ronan, nearly imperceptible. At some point it became the gray man watching the space between the two of them instead of Ronan. Finally, the gray man said, "If I don't return with the Grey Warren on the 4th of July, they're telling my brother where I am, and he will kill me. He will do it very slowly." Ronan believed him in a way that he didn't believe most things in life. It was real, like a memory. This strange man would be tormented in the bathroom of one of the Henrietta motels, and then he would be discarded, and no one would ever look for him. The gray man didn't have to tell any of them how much easier it would be to merely take Ronan to his employer. He also didn't have to tell any of them how simple it would be to do it against Ronan's will. Though Callis stood beside the gun of his that she'd retrieved from the cabinet, now Ronan saw why Ronan didn't believe in it. If it came down to them versus Mr. Gray, he thought, Mr. Gray would win. It was like hearing the night horrors coming in his dreams, the inevitability of it. Gansey very softly said, "Please." Mora sighed. "Brothers," said the gray man. He did not mean Declan or Matthew. At once, the power went out of him. "I don't care for birds." Then after a moment, "I'm not a kidnapper." Mora shot a rather meaningful look at Calla, who pretended not to see it. "Are you sure your brother will be able to find you?" Gansey asked. "I'm certain I won't be able to go home again," the gray man said. "I don't have many things there, but my books. I would have to stay on a move for quite a while. It took me years to lose him before. And even if I leave, it won't stop the others. They're tracking the energy abnormalities above and beyond what runs through Henrietta, and right now, they point right at him." He looked at Ronan. Gansey, who had looked aghast at the idea of the gray man having to abandon his books, frowned even deeper. "Could you dream a Grey Warren?" Blue asked Ronan. "I'm not giving this to anyone else," Ronan growled. He knew he should be kinder. They were trying to help him after all. "It's killing the ley line as it is. You want to see Noah again? I'm stopping." "But Kavinsky's not. It would be like standing next to a giant bullseye." "You could lie," Calla suggested. "Give them something and tell them it's the Grey Warren and let them think they aren't clever enough to figure out how to work it." "My employer," said the gray man, "is not an understanding man. If he ever discovered or suspected a ruse, it would be very ugly for all of us." "What would they do to me?" Ronan asked. "To Kavinsky?" "If you turned me in." "No," Gansey said, as if replying to an entirely different question. "No," the gray man agreed. "Don't say no," Ronan insisted. "Fucking tell me. I didn't say I'd do it, I just want to know." Gray man took his suitcase to the table, opened it, and laid the gun inside on top of the neatly folded slacks. He closed it. "He is not interested in people. He is interested in things. He will find the thing that makes you work, and he will remove it. He will put it in a glass box with a label, and when his guests have had enough wine, he will take them down to where you are and show them that thing that was inside you. And then they will admire the other things in the other cases beside you." When Ronan didn't flinch, the gray man couldn't know that Ronan would rather do most anything than flinch, he continued. "It's possible he would make an exception for you, but it would only be that he'd put all of you in the glass box. He is a curator. He will do what he needs to do for his collection." Ronan still didn't flinch. The gray man said, He told me to kill your father as messily as I could and leave the body where your older brother would find it, so that he would confess to where the Grey Warren was. For one moment, Ronan didn't move. It took him that long to realize that the Grey Man was saying he had killed Neil Lynch. Ronan's mind went perfectly blank. Then he did what had to be done. He hurled himself at the Grey Man. Chainsaw blasted into the air. "Ronan!" howled approximately three voices at once. The Grey Man let out a small oof with the ferocity of the hit. Three or four punches landed on his person. It was difficult to tell if it was through skill on Ronan's part or permissiveness on the Grey Man's. Then the Grey Man gently threw Ronan across the breakfast table. "Mr. Grey!" shouted Mora, forgetting his fake name in the heat of the moment. Chainsaw cannonballed toward the Grey Man's face. As he ducked his eyes against her, Ronan slammed into the Grey Man's stomach. He somehow managed to include several swear words in the blow. The Grey Man, searching for footing, smacked the back of his head against the door jamb behind him. "You must be joking!" This was Kala. "You